and weather, the most minute shifts in time of day. Long before seeds were stirring, Frida and I were scruffing and poking at the earth, swallowing air, drinking rain. As we emerged from the school with Maureen, we began to molt immediately. We put our headscarves in our coat pockets and our coats on our heads. I was wondering how to maneuver Maureen's fur muff into a gutter when a commotion in the playground distracted us. A group of boys was circling and holding at bay a victim, Picola Breedlove. Bay Boy, Woodrow Kane, Buddy Wilson, Junie Bug, like a necklace of semi-precious stones, they surrounded her, heady with the smell of their own musk, thrilled by the easy power of a majority. They gaily harassed her. Blackie Mo, your daddy sleeps naked. Blackie Mo, your daddy sleeps naked. Blackie Mo. They had extemporized a verse made up of two insults about matters over which the victim had no control, the color of her skin and speculations on the sleeping habits of an adult, wildly fitting in its incoherence. That they themselves were black, or that their own father had similarly relaxed habits, was irrelevant. It was their contempt for their own blackness that gave the first insult its teeth. They seemed to have taken all of their smoothly cultivated ignorance, their exquisitely learned self-hatred, their elaborately designed hopelessness, and sucked it all up into a fiery cone of scorn that had burned for ages in the hollows of their minds, cooled and spilled over lips of outrage, consuming whatever was in its path. They danced a macabre ballet around the victim, whom, for their own sake, they were prepared to sacrifice to the flaming pit. Blackie Mo, your daddy sleeps naked. Ta-ta, 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 ta-ta. Picola edged around the circle crying. She had dropped her notebook and covered her eyes with her hands. We watched, afraid they might notice us and turn their energies our way. Then Frida, with set lips and Mama's eyes, snatched her coat from her head and threw it on the ground. She ran toward them and brought her books down on Woodrow Kane's head. The circle broke. Woodrow Kane grabbed his head. "Hey, girl! You cut that out, you hear?" I had never heard Frida's voice so loud and clear. Maybe because Frida was taller than he was. Maybe because he saw her eyes. Maybe because he had lost interest in the game. Or maybe because he had a crush on Frida. In any case, Woodrow looked frightened just long enough to give her more courage. "Leave her alone. I'm gonna tell everybody what you did." Woodrow did not answer. He just walled his eyes. Bay Boy piped up. "Go on, gal, ain't nobody bothering you." "You shut up, Bullethead." I had found my tongue. "Who you calling Bullethead?" "I'm calling you Bullethead, Bullethead." Frida took Picola's hand. "Come on." "You want a fat lip?" Bay Boy drew back, his fist at me. "Yeah, give me one of yours. You gonna get one." Maureen appeared at my elbow, and the boys seemed reluctant to continue under her springtime eyes, so wide with interest. They buckled in confusion, not willing to beat up three girls under her watchful gaze. So they listened to a budding male instinct that told them to pretend we were unworthy of their attention. "Come on, man." "Yeah, come on. We ain't got time to fool with them." Grumbling a few disinterested epithets, they moved away. I picked up Picola's notebook and Frida's coat, and the four of us left the playground. "Old Bullethead, he's always picking on girls." Frida agreed with me. "Miss Forrester said he was incorrigible." "Really?" I didn't know what that meant. but it had enough of a doom sound in it to be true of Bayboy. While Frida and I clucked on about the near fight, Maureen, suddenly animated, put her velvet-sleeved arm through Picola's and began to behave as though they were the closest of friends. I just moved here. My name is Maureen Peel. What's yours? Picola. Picola? Wasn't that the name of the girl in Imitation of Life? I don't know. What is that? The picture show, you know, where this mulatto girl hates her mother because she's black and ugly, but then cries at the funeral. It was real sad. Everybody cries in it. Claudette Colbert, too. Oh, Picola's voice was no more than a sigh. Anyway, her name was Picola, too. She was so pretty. And when it comes back, I'm going to see it again. My mother has seen it 4 times. Frida and I walked behind them, surprised at Maureen's friendliness to Picola, but pleased. Maybe she wasn't so bad after all. Frida had put her coat back on her head, and the two of us, so draped, trotted along, enjoying the warm breeze and Frida's heroics. "You're in my gym class, aren't you?" Maureen asked Picola. "Yes. Miss Erdmeister's legs sure are bow. I bet she thinks they're cute. How come she gets to wear real shorts and we have to wear those old bloomers? I want to die every time I put them on." Picola smiled, but did not look at Maureen. "Hey," Maureen stopped short. "There's an Isley's. Want some ice cream? I have money." She unzipped a hidden pocket in her muff and pulled out a multi-folded dollar bill. I forgave her those knee socks. "My uncle sued Isley's," Maureen said to the three of us. "He sued the Isley's in Akron. They said he was disorderly, and that was why they wouldn't serve him. But a friend of his, a policeman, came in and bared the witness, so the suit went through." "What's a suit?" "It's when you can beat them up if you want to, and won't anybody do nothing. Our family does it all the time. We believe in suits." At the entrance to Isley's, Maureen turned to Frida and me, asking, "You all gonna buy some ice cream?" We looked at each other. "No," Frida said. Maureen disappeared into the store with Picola. Frida looked placidly down the street. I opened my mouth, but quickly closed it. It was extremely important that the world not know that I fully expected Maureen to buy us some ice cream. That for the past 120 seconds, I had been selecting the flavor, that I had begun to like Maureen, and that neither of us had a penny. We supposed Maureen was being nice to Picola because of the boys, and were embarrassed to be caught even by each other, thinking that she would treat us or that we deserved it as much as Picola did. The girls came out, Picola with 2 dips of orange pineapple, Maureen with black raspberry. "You should have got some," she said. "They had all kinds." "Don't eat down to the tip of the cone," she advised Picola. "Why?" "Because there's a fly in there." "How you know?" "Oh, not really. A girl told me she found one in the bottom of hers once, and ever since then, she throws that part away." "Oh." We passed the Dreamland Theater, and Betty Grable smiled down at us. "Don't you just love her?" Maureen asked. "Uh-huh," said Picola. I differed. "Hedy Lamarr is better." Maureen agreed. "Oh, yes. My mother told me that a girl named Audrey, she went to the beauty parlor where we lived before and asked the lady to fix her hair like Hedy Lamarr's. And the lady said, 'Yeah, when you grow some hair like Hedy Lamarr's.'" She laughed, long and sweet. "Sounds crazy," said Frida. "She sure is. Do you know she doesn't even menstruate yet? And she's 16. Do you yet?" "Yes," Picola glanced at us. So do I. Maureen made no attempt to disguise her pride. 2 months ago I started. My girlfriend in Toledo, where we lived before, said when she started, she was scared to death, thought she had killed herself. Do you know what it's for? Picola asked the question, as though hoping to provide the answer herself. For babies. Maureen raised 2 pencil-stroke eyebrows at the obviousness of the question. Babies need blood when they're inside you. And if you're having a baby, then you don't menstruate. But when you're not having a baby, then you don't have to save the blood, so it comes out. How do babies get the blood? Asked Picola. Through the like line. You know, where your belly button is? That is where the like line grows from and pumps the blood to the baby. Well, if the belly buttons are to grow like lines to give the baby blood and only girls have babies, how come boys have belly buttons? Maureen hesitated. I don't know, she admitted. But boys have all sorts of things they don't need. Her tinkling laughter was somehow stronger than our nervous ones. She curled her tongue around the edge of the cone, scooping up a dollop of purple that made my eyes water. We were waiting for a stoplight to change. Maureen kept scooping the ice cream from around the cone's edge with her tongue. She didn't bite the edge as I would have done. Her tongue circled the cone. Picola had finished hers. Maureen evidently liked her things to last. While I was thinking about her ice cream, she must have been thinking about her last remark, for she said to Picola, "Did you ever see a naked man?" Picola blinked, then looked away. "No. Where would I see a naked man?" "I don't know. I just asked." "I wouldn't even look at him. Even if I did see him. That's dirty. Who wants to see a naked man?" Picola was agitated. Nobody's father would be naked in front of his own daughter. Not unless he was dirty, too. "I didn't say father. I just said a naked man." "Well, how come you said father?" Maureen wanted to know. "Who else would she see, Dogtooth?" I was glad to have a chance to show anger. Not only because of the ice cream, but because we had seen our own father naked and didn't care to be reminded of it and feel the shame brought on by the absence of shame. He had been walking down the hall from the bathroom into his bedroom and past the open door of our room. We had lain there, wide-eyed. He stopped and looked in, trying to see in the dark room whether we were really asleep. Or was it his imagination that opened eyes were looking at him? Apparently he convinced himself that we were sleeping. He moved away, confident that his little girls would not lie open-eyed like that, staring, staring. When he had moved on, the dark took only him away, not his nakedness. That stayed in the room with us, friendly-like. "I'm not talking to you," said Maureen. "Besides, I don't care if she sees her father naked. She can look at him all day if she wants to. Who cares?" "You do," said Frida. "That's all you talk about." "It is not. It is so. Boys, babies, and somebody's naked daddy. You must be boy crazy. You better be quiet. Who's gonna make me?" Frida put her hand on her hip and jutted her face toward Maureen. "You already made, mammy made. You stop talking about my mama. Would you stop talking about my daddy? Who said anything about your old daddy? You did. Well, you started it. I wasn't even talking to you. I was talking to Picola." "Yeah, about seeing her naked daddy. So what if she did see him?" Picola shouted. "I never saw my daddy naked, never." "You did too," Maureen snapped. "Bay boy said so." "I did not." "You did." "I did not." "Did. Your own daddy, too." Picola tucked her head in. A funny, sad, helpless movement, a kind of hunching of the shoulders, pulling in of the neck, as though she wanted to cover her ears. "You stop talking about her daddy," I said. "What do I care about her old black daddy?" asked Maureen. "Black? Who you calling black? You. You think you so cute?" I swung at her and missed, hitting Piccola in the face. Furious at my clumsiness, I threw my notebook at her, but it caught her in the small of her velvet back, for she had turned and was flying across the street, against traffic. Safe on the other side, she screamed at us, "I am cute, and you ugly, black and ugly blackie-mos. I am cute." She ran down the street, the green knee socks making her legs look like wild dandelion stems that had somehow lost their heads. The weight of her remarks stunned us, and it was a second or two before Frida and I collected ourselves enough to shout, "Six-finger dog-tooth meringue pie." We chanted this most powerful of our arsenal of insults as long as we could see the green stems and rabbit fur. Grown people frowned at the three girls on the curbside, two with their coats draped over their heads, the collars framing the eyebrows like nuns' habits, black garters showing where they bit the tops of brown stockings that barely covered the knees, angry faces knotted like dark cauliflowers. Piccola stood a little apart from us, her eyes hinged in the direction in which Maureen had fled. She seemed to fold into herself like a pleated wing. Her pain antagonized me. I wanted to open her up, crisp her edges, ram a stick down that hunched and curving spine, force her to stand erect and spit the misery out on the streets. But she held it in, where it could lap up into her eyes. Frida snatched her coat from her head. "Come on, Claudia. Bye, Piccola." We walked quickly at first, and then slower, pausing every now and then to fasten garters, tie shoelaces, scratch, or examine old scars. We were sinking under the wisdom, accuracy, and relevance of Maureen's last words. If she was cute, and if anything could be believed she was, then we were not. And what did that mean? We were lesser, nicer, brighter, but still lesser. Dolls we could destroy, but we could not destroy the honey voices of parents and aunts, the obedience in the eyes of our peers, the slippery light in the eyes of our teachers when they encountered the Maureen Peels of the world. What was the secret? What did we lack? Why was it important? And so what? Guileless and without vanity, we were still in love with ourselves then. We felt comfortable in our skins, enjoyed the news that our senses released to us, admired our dirt, cultivated our scars, and could not comprehend this unworthiness. Jealousy we understood and thought natural, a desire to have what somebody else had. But envy was a strange, new feeling for us. All that time, we knew that Maureen Peel was not the enemy and not worthy of such intense hatred. The thing to fear was the thing that made her beautiful and not us. The house was quiet when we opened the door. The acrid smell of simmering turnips filled our cheeks with sour saliva. "Mama?" There was no answer, but a sound of feet. Mr. Henry shuffled part of the way down the stairs. One thick, hairless leg leaned out of his bathrobe. "Hello there, Greta Garbo. Hello, Ginger Rogers." We gave him the giggle he was accustomed to. "Hello, Mr. Henry. Where's Mama?" "She went to your grandma's. Left word for you to cut off the turnips and eat some graham crackers till she got back," then the kitchen. We sat in silence at the kitchen table, crumbling the crackers into anthills. In a little while, Mr. Henry came back down the stairs. Now he had his trousers on, under his robe. "Say, wouldn't you all like some ice cream?" "Oh, yes, sir." "Here, here's a quarter. Go on over to Isley's and get yourself some cream. You been good girls, ain't you?" His light green words restored color to the day. "Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Henry. Will you tell Mama for us if she comes?" "Sure, but she ain't due back for a spell." Coatless, we left the house and had gotten all the way to the corner when Frida said, "I don't want to go to Isley's." "What?" "I don't want ice cream. I want potato chips." "They got potato chips at Isley's?" "I know, but why go all that long way? Miss Bertha got potato chips." "But I want ice cream." "No, you don't, Claudia." "I do, too." "Well, you go on to Isley's. I'm going to Miss Bertha's." "But you got the quarter, and I don't want to go all the way up there by myself." "Then let's go to Miss Bertha's. You like her candy, don't you? It's always stale, and she always runs out of stuff. Today is Friday. She orders fresh on Friday. And then that crazy old soaphead church lives there. So what? We're together. We'll run if he does anything at us." "He scares me." "Well, I don't want to go up by Isley's. Suppose meringue pie is hanging around. You want to run into her, Claudia?" "Come on, Frida. I'll get candy." Miss Bertha had a small candy, snuff, and tobacco store. One brick room sitting in her front yard. You had to peep in the door, and if she wasn't there, you knocked on the door of her house in back. This day, she was sitting behind the counter, reading a Bible in a tube of sunlight. Frida bought potato chips, and we got 3 powerhouse bars for 10 cents and had a dime left. We hurried back home to sit under the lilac bushes on the side of the house. We always did our candy dance there, so Rosemary could see us and get jealous. The candy dance was a humming, skipping, foot-tapping, eating, smacking combination that overtook us when we had sweets. Creeping between the bushes and the side of the house, we heard voices and laughter. We looked into the living room window, expecting to see Mama. Instead, we saw Mr. Henry and 2 women. In a playful manner, the way grandmothers do with babies, he was sucking the fingers of one of the women, whose laughter filled a tiny place over his head. The other woman was buttoning her coat. We knew immediately who they were, and our flesh crawled. One was China, and the other was called the Maginot Line. The back of my neck itched. These were the fancy women of the maroon nail polish that Mama and Big Mama hated, and in our house. China was not too terrible, at least not in our imaginations. She was thin, aging, absent-minded, and unaggressive. But the Maginot Line? That was the one my mother said she wouldn't let eat out of one of her plates. That was the one church women never allowed their eyes to rest on. That was the one who had killed people, set them on fire, poisoned them, cooked them in lye. Although I thought the Maginot Line's face, hidden under all that fat, was really sweet. I had heard too many black and red words about her, seen too many mouths go triangle at the mention of her name, to dwell on any redeeming features she might have. Showing brown teeth, China seemed to be genuinely enjoying Mr. Henry. The sight of him licking her fingers brought to mind the girly magazines in his room. A cold wind blew somewhere in me, lifting little leaves of terror and obscure longing. I thought I saw a mild lonesomeness cross the face of the Maginot Line. but it may have been my own image that I saw in the slow flaring of her nostrils, in her eyes that reminded me of waterfalls and movies about Hawaii. The Maginot Line yawned and said, "Come on, China. We can't hang in here all day. Then people be home soon." She moved toward the door. Frida and I dropped down to the ground, looking wildly into each other's eyes. When the women were some distance away, we went inside. Mr. Henry was in the kitchen, opening a bottle of pop. "Back already?" "Yes, sir." "Cream all gone?" His little teeth looked so kindly and helpless. Was that really our Mr. Henry with China's fingers? "We got candy instead." "You did, huh? Old sugar tooth Greta Garbo." He wiped the bottle sweat and turned it up to his lips, a gesture that made me uncomfortable. "Who were those women, Mr. Henry?" He choked on the pop and looked at Frida. "What'd she say?" "Those women," she repeated, "who just left. Who were they?" "Oh," he laughed, the grown-up getting ready to lie laugh, a he-he we knew well. "Those are some members of my Bible class. We read the scriptures together, and so they came today to read with me." "Oh," said Frida. I was looking at his house slippers to keep from seeing those kindly teeth frame a lie. He walked toward the stairs and then turned back to us. "Better not mention it to your mother. She don't take to so much Bible study and don't like me having visitors, even if they're good Christians." "No, sir, Mr. Henry, we won't." He rapidly mounted the stairs. "Should we?" I asked. "Tell Mama?" Frida sighed. She had not even opened her powerhouse bar or her potato chips, and now she traced the letters on the candy wrappers with her fingers. Suddenly, she lifted her head and began to look all around the kitchen. "No, I guess not. No plates are out." "Plates? What are you talking about now? No plates are out. The Maginot Line didn't eat out of one of Mama's plates. Besides, Mama would just fuss all day if we told her." We sat down and looked at the graham cracker anthills we had made. "We better cut off the turnips, they'll burn, and Mama will whip us," she said. "I know, but if we let them burn, we won't have to eat them." "Hey, what a lovely idea," I thought. "What you want, a whipping and no turnips, or turnips and no whippings?" "I don't know. Maybe we could burn them just a little, so Mama and Daddy can eat them, but we can say we can't." "Okay." I made a volcano out of my anthill. "Frida, what? What did Woodrow do that you was gonna tell?" "Wet the bed. Mrs. Kane told Mama he won't quit." "Oh, nasty." The sky was getting dark. I looked out of the window and saw snow falling. I poked my finger down into the mouth of my volcano, and it toppled, dispersing the golden grains into little swirls. The turnip pot crackled. "See the cat? It goes meow, meow, come and play. Come play with Jane, the kitten will not play. Play, play, play." They come from Mobile, Aiken, from Newport News, from Marietta, from Meridian, and the sound of those places in their mouths make you think of love. When you ask them where they're from, they tilt their heads and say, "Mobile," and you think you've been kissed. They say, "Aiken," and you see a white butterfly glance off a fence with a torn wing. They say, "Nacogdoches," and you want to say, "Yes, I will." You don't know what these towns are like, but you love what happens to the air when they open their lips and let the names ease out. Meridian. The sound of it opens the windows of a room like the first four notes of a hymn. Few people can say the names of their hometowns with such sly affection. Perhaps they don't have hometowns, just places where they were born. But these girls soak up the juice of their hometowns, and it never leaves them. They are thin brown girls who have looked long at hollyhocks in the backyards of Meridian, Mobile, Aiken, and Baton Rouge. And like hollyhocks, they are narrow, tall, and still. Their roots are deep, their stalks are firm, and only the top blossom nods in the wind. They have the eyes of people who can tell what time it is by the color of the sky. Such girls live in quiet black neighborhoods where everybody is gainfully employed, where there are porch swings hanging from chains, where the grass is cut with a scythe, where rooster combs and sunflowers grow in the yards, and pots of bleeding heart, ivy, and mother-in-law tongue line the steps and window sills. Such girls have bought watermelon and snap beans from the fruit man's wagon. They have put in the window the cardboard sign that has a pound measure printed on each of three edges, 10 pounds, 25 pounds, 50 pounds, and no ice on the fourth. These particular brown girls from Mobile and Aiken are not like some of their sisters. They are not fretful, nervous, or shrill. They do not have lovely black necks that stretch as though against an invisible collar. Their eyes do not bite. These sugar brown Mobile girls move through the streets without a stir. They are as sweet and plain as butter cake, slim ankles, long, narrow feet. They wash themselves with orange-colored Lifebuoy soap, dust themselves with cashmere bouquet talc, clean their teeth with salt on a piece of rag, soften their skin with Jergens lotion. They smell like wood, newspapers, and vanilla. They straighten their hair with Dixie Peach and part it on the side. At night, they curl it in paper from brown bags, tie a print scarf around their heads, and sleep with hands folded across their stomachs. They do not drink, smoke, or swear, and they still call sex nookie. They sing second soprano in the choir, and although their voices are clear and steady, they are never picked to solo. They're in the second row, white blouses starched, blue skirts almost purple from ironing. They go to land-grant colleges, normal schools, and learn how to do the white man's work with refinement. Home economics to prepare his food, teacher education to instruct black children in obedience, music to soothe the weary master and entertain his blunted soul. Here, they learn the rest of the lesson begun in those soft houses with porch swings and pots of bleeding heart, how to behave. The careful development of thrift, patience, high morals, and good manners. In short, how to get rid of the funkiness, the dreadful funkiness of passion, the funkiness of nature, the funkiness of the wide range of human emotions. Wherever it erupts, this funk, they wipe it away. Where it crusts, they dissolve it. Wherever it drips, flowers, or clings, they find it and fight it till it dies. They fight this battle all the way to the grave. The laugh that is a little too loud, the enunciation a little too round, the gesture a little too generous. They hold their behind in for fear of a sway too free. When they wear lipstick, they never cover the entire mouth for fear of lips too thick, and they worry, worry, worry about the edges of their hair. They never seem to have boyfriends, but they always marry. Certain men watch them without seeming to, and know that if such a girl is in his house, he will sleep on sheets boiled white, hung out to dry on juniper bushes, and pressed flat with a heavy iron. There will be pretty paper flowers decorating the picture of his mother, a large Bible in the front room. They feel secure. They know their work clothes will be mended, washed, and ironed on Monday, that their Sunday shirts will billow on hangers from the door jamb, stiffly starched and white. They look at her hands and know what she will do with biscuit dough. They smell the coffee and the fried ham, see the white, smoky grits with a dollop of butter on top. Her hips assure them that she will bear children easily and painlessly, and they're right. What they do not know is that this plain brown girl will build her nest stick by stick, make it her own inviolable world, and stand guard over its every plant, weed, and doily, even against him. In silence will she return the lamp to where she put it in the first place, remove the dishes from the table as soon as the last bite is taken, wipe the doorknob after a greasy hand has touched it. A sidelong look will be enough to tell him to smoke on the back porch. Children will sense instantly that they cannot come into her yard to retrieve a ball. But the men do not know these things, nor do they know that she will give him her body sparingly and partially. He must enter her surreptitiously, lifting the hem of her nightgown only to her navel. He must rest his weight on his elbows when they make love, ostensibly to avoid hurting her breasts, but actually to keep her from having to touch or feel too much of him. While he moves inside her, she will wonder why they didn't put the necessary but private parts of the body in some more convenient place, like the armpit, for example, or the palm of the hand, some place one could get to easily and quickly without undressing. She stiffens when she feels one of her paper curlers coming undone from the activity of love. Imprints in her mind which one it is that's coming loose, so she can quickly secure it once he's through. She hopes he will not sweat. The damp may get into her hair, and that she will remain dry between her legs. She hates the glucking sound they make when she is moist. When she senses some spasm about to grip him, she will make rapid movements with her hips, press her fingernails into his back, suck in her breath, and pretend she's having an orgasm. She might wonder again, for the 600th time, what it would be like to have that feeling while her husband's penis is inside her. The closest thing to it was the time she was walking down the street and her napkin slipped free of her sanitary belt. It moved gently between her legs as she walked, gently, ever so gently. And then a slight and distinctly delicious sensation collected in her crotch. As the delight grew, she had to stop in the street, hold her thighs together to contain it. That must be what it is like, she thinks. But it never happens while he is inside her. When he withdraws, she pulls her nightgown down, slips out of the bed and into the bathroom with relief. Occasionally, some living thing will engage her affections, a cat perhaps, who will love her order, precision, and constancy, who will be as clean and quiet as she is. The cat will settle quietly on the windowsill and caress her with his eyes. She can hold him in her arms, letting his back paws struggle for footing on her breast, and his forepaws cling to her shoulder. She can rub the smooth fur and feel the unresisting flesh underneath. At her gentlest touch, he will preen, stretch, and open his mouth, and she will accept the strangely pleasant sensation that comes when he writhes beneath her hand and flattens his eyes with a surfeit of sensual delight. When she stands cooking at the table, he will circle about her shanks, and the trill of his fur spirals up her legs to her thighs to make her fingers tremble a little in the pie dough. Or, as she sits reading the uplifting thoughts in the Liberty magazine, the cat will jump into her lap. She will fondle that soft hill of hair and let the warmth of the animal's body seep over and into the deeply private areas of her lap. Sometimes the magazine drops, and she opens her legs just a little, and the two of them will be still together, perhaps shifting a little together, sleeping a little together, until 4 o'clock, when the intruder comes home from work, vaguely anxious about what's for dinner. The cat will always know that he is first in her affections, even after she bears a child, for she does bear a child, easily and painlessly, but only one, a son named Junior. One such girl from Mobile or Meridian or Aiken, who did not sweat in her armpits nor between her thighs, who smelled of wood and vanilla, who had made souffles in the home economics department, moved with her husband Louis to Lorain, Ohio. Her name was Geraldine. There, she built her nest, ironed shirts, potted bleeding hearts, played with her cat, and birthed Louis Jr. Geraldine did not allow her baby Jr. to cry. As long as his needs were physical, she could meet them, comfort and satiety. He was always brushed, bathed, oiled, and shod. Geraldine did not talk to him, coo to him, or indulge him in kissing bouts, but she saw that every other desire was fulfilled. It was not long before the child discovered the difference in his mother's behavior to himself and the cat. As he grew older, he learned how to direct his hatred of his mother to the cat and spent some happy moments watching it suffer. The cat survived because Geraldine was seldom away from home and could effectively soothe the animal when Junior abused him. Geraldine, Louis, Junior, and the cat lived next to the playground of Washington Irving School. Junior considered the playground his own, and the school children coveted his freedom to sleep late, go home for lunch, and dominate the playground after school. He hated to see the swings, slides, monkey bars, and seesaws empty, and tried to get kids to stick around as long as possible. White kids. His mother did not like him to play with the niggers. She had explained to him the difference between colored people and niggers. They were easily identifiable. Colored people were neat and quiet. Niggers were dirty and loud. He belonged to the former group. He wore white shirts and blue trousers. His hair was cut as close to his scalp as possible, to avoid any suggestion of wool. The part was etched into his hair by the barber. In winter, his mother put Jergens lotion on his face to keep the skin from becoming ashen. Even though he was light-skinned, it was possible to Ash. The line between colored and nigger was not always clear. Subtle and telltale signs threatened to erode it, and the watch had to be constant. Junior used to long to play with the black boys. More than anything in the world, he wanted to play King of the Mountain and have them push him down the mound of dirt and roll over him. He wanted to feel their hardness pressing on him, smell their wild blackness, and say fuck you with that lovely casualness. He wanted to sit with them on curbstones and compare the sharpness of jackknives, the distance and arcs of spitting. In the toilet, he wanted to share with them the laurels of being able to pee far and long. Bayboy and PL had at one time been his idols. Gradually, he came to agree with his mother that neither Bayboy nor PL was good enough for him. He played only with Ralph Nesinski, who was 2 years younger, wore glasses, and didn't want to do anything. More and more, Junior enjoyed bullying girls. It was easy making them scream and run. How he laughed when they fell down and their bloomers showed. When they got up, their faces red and crinkled, it made him feel good. The nigger girls he did not pick on very much. They usually traveled in packs, and once when he threw a stone at some of them, they chased, caught, and beat him witless. He lied to his mother, saying Bayboy did it. His mother was very upset. His father just kept on reading the Lorraine Journal. When the mood struck him, he would call a child passing by to come and play on the swings or the seesaw. If the child wouldn't or did and left too soon, Junior threw gravel at him. He became a very good shot. Alternately bored and frightened at home, the playground was his joy. On a day when he had been especially idle, he saw a very black girl taking a shortcut through the playground. She kept her head down as she walked. He had seen her many times before, standing alone, always alone, at recess. Nobody ever played with her. Probably, he thought, because she was ugly. Now Junior called to her. Hey, what are you doing walking through my yard? The girl stopped. Nobody can come through this yard unless I say so. This ain't your yard. It's the school's. But I'm in charge of it. The girl started to walk away. Wait, Junior walked toward her. You can play in it if you want to. What's your name? Piccola. I don't want to play. Come on. I'm not going to bother you. I gotta go home. Say, you want to see something? I got something to show you. No. What is it? Come on in my house. See, I live right here. Come on. I'll show you. Show me what? Some kittens. We got some kittens. You can have one if you want. Real kittens? Yeah. Come on. He pulled gently at her dress. Piccola began to move toward his house. When he knew she had agreed, Junior ran ahead excitedly, stopping only to yell back at her to come on. He held the door open for her, smiling his encouragement. Piccola climbed the porch stairs and hesitated there, afraid to follow him. The house looked dark. Junior said, there's nobody here. My ma's gone out, and my father's at work. Don't you want to see the kittens? Junior turned on the lights. Piccola stepped inside the door. How beautiful, she thought. What a beautiful house. There was a big red and gold Bible on the dining room table. Little lace doilies were everywhere, on arms and backs of chairs, in the center of a large dining table, on little tables. Potted plants were on all the windowsills. A color picture of Jesus Christ hung on a wall with the prettiest paper flowers fastened on the frame. She wanted to see everything slowly, slowly. But Junior kept saying, "Hey, you, come on, come on." He pulled her into another room, even more beautiful than the first. More doilies, a big lamp with green and gold base and white shade. There was even a rug on the floor with enormous dark red flowers. She was deep in admiration of the flowers when Junior said, "Here." Piccola turned. "Here's your kitten," he screeched, and he threw a big black cat right in her face. She sucked in her breath in fear and surprise and felt fur in her mouth. The cat clawed her face and chest in an effort to right itself, then leaped nimbly to the floor. Junior was laughing and running around the room, clutching his stomach delightedly. Piccola touched the scratched place on her face and felt tears coming. When she started toward the doorway, Junior leaped in front of her. "You can't get out. You're my prisoner," he said. His eyes were merry, but hard. "You let me go." "No." He pushed her down, ran out the door that separated the rooms, and held it shut with his hands. Piccola's banging on the door increased his gasping, high-pitched laughter. The tears came fast, and she held her face in her hands. When something soft and furry moved around her ankles, she jumped and saw it was the cat. He wound himself in and about her legs. Momentarily distracted from her fear, she squatted down to touch him, her hands wet from the tears. The cat rubbed up against her knee. He was black all over, deep, silky black, and his eyes, pointing down toward his nose, were bluish green. The light made them shine like blue ice. Piccola rubbed the cat's head. He whined, his tongue flicking with pleasure. The blue eyes in the black face held her. Junior, curious at not hearing her sobs, opened the door and saw her squatting down, rubbing the cat's back. He saw the cat stretching its head and flattening its eyes. He had seen that expression many times as the animal responded to his mother's touch. "Give me my cat," his voice broke. With a movement both awkward and sure, he snatched the cat by one of its hind legs and began to swing it around his head in a circle. "Stop that," Piccola was screaming. The cat's free paws were stiffened, ready to grab anything to restore balance, its mouth wide, its eyes blue streaks of horror. Still screaming, Piccola reached for Junior's hand. She heard her dress rip under her arm. Junior tried to push her away, but she grabbed the arm which was swinging the cat. They both fell, and in falling, Junior let go the cat, which, having been released in mid-motion, was thrown full force against the window. It slithered down and fell on the radiator behind the sofa. Except for a few shudders, it was still. There was only the slightest smell of singed fur. Geraldine opened the door. "What is this?" Her voice was mild, as though asking a perfectly reasonable question. "Who is this girl?" "She killed our cat," said Junior. "Look." He pointed to the radiator where the cat lay, its blue eyes closed, leaving only an empty, black, and helpless face. Geraldine went to the radiator and picked up the cat. He was limp in her arms, but she rubbed her face in his fur. She looked at Piccola, saw the dirty, torn dress, the plaits sticking out on her head, hair matted where the plaits had come undone, the muddy shoes with the wad of gum peeping out from between the cheap soles, the soiled socks, one of which had been walked down into the heel of the shoe. She saw the safety pin holding the hem of the dress up. Up over the hump of the cat's back, she looked at her. She'd seen this little girl all of her life, hanging out of windows over saloons in Mobile, crawling over the porches of shotgun houses on the edge of town, sitting in bus stations, holding paper bags, and crying to mothers who kept saying, "Shut up." Hair uncombed, dresses falling apart, shoes untied and caked with dirt. They had stared at her with great, uncomprehending eyes, eyes that questioned nothing and asked everything. Unblinking and unabashed, they stared up at her. The end of the world lay in their eyes, and the beginning and all the waste in between. They were everywhere. They slept six in a bed, all their pee mixing together in the night as they wet their beds, each in his own candy and potato chip dream. In the long, hot days, they idled away, picking plaster from the walls and digging into the earth with sticks. They sat in little rows on street curbs, crowded into pews at church, taking space from the nice, neat, colored children. They clowned on the playgrounds, broke things in dime stores, ran in front of you on the street, made ice slides on the sloped sidewalks in winter. The girls grew up knowing nothing of girdles, and the boys announced their manhood by turning the bills of their caps backward. Grass wouldn't grow where they lived. Flowers died. Shades fell down. Tin cans and tires blossomed where they lived. They lived on cold, black-eyed peas and orange pop. Like flies they hovered, like flies they settled, and this one had settled in her house. Up over the hump of the cat's back, she looked. "Get out," she said, her voice quiet. "You nasty little black bitch. Get out of my house." The cat shuddered and flicked his tail. Piccola backed out of the room, staring at the pretty milk-brown lady in the pretty golden-green house who was talking to her through the cat's fur. The pretty lady's words made the cat fur move. The breath of each word parted the fur. Piccola turned to find the front door and saw Jesus looking down at her with sad and unsurprised eyes, his long brown hair parted in the middle, the gay paper flowers twisted around his face. Outside, the March wind blew into the rip in her dress. She held her head down against the cold, but she could not hold it low enough to avoid seeing the snowflakes falling and dying on the pavement. Spring. The first twigs are thin, green, and supple. They bend into a complete circle but will not break. Their delicate, showy hopefulness, shooting from forsythia and lilac bushes, meant only a change in whipping style. They beat us differently in the spring. Instead of the dull pain of a winter strap, there were these new green switches that lost their sting long after the whipping was over. There was a nervous meanness in these long twigs that made us long for the steady stroke of a strap or the firm but honest slap of a hairbrush. Even now, spring for me is shot through with the remembered ache of switchings, and forsythia holds no cheer. Sunk in the grass of an empty lot on a spring Saturday, I split the stems of milkweed and thought about ants and peach pits and death and where the world went when I closed my eyes. I must have lain long in the grass, for the shadow that was in front of me when I left the house had disappeared when I went back. I entered the house as the house was bursting.